Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you, and she's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha. Welcome to the Progressive Radio Network. It is August 26th, 2014. This is Nature Bats Last. It's MB Young on PRN.FM. Our theme song, Nature Bats Last, is provided with our thanks by Afrozen, and you can find more of his work on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com. I'm Mike Sliva, and you can find me at Michael, S-L-I-W-A, .wordpress.com. Well, it's my first solo effort. The Good Doctor is out on assignment, and he will be back live next week, although we have some pre-recorded stuff with him this week, and, of course, his all-important climate and summary update later on in the show. Next week, I will be gone for some time on the road, and so he will be flying solo with some pre-recorded stuff from myself. Let me start the show by wishing my sister a happy 44th birthday. Happy birthday, Jennifer. And this week's show commences with two news items beyond the mainstream. The first doubles as the climate change update of the week and describes the Harper's government response to science about ice melt in the Arctic. The second describes how women warriors take environmental protection in their own hands. And we'll be speaking with Greg Peterson about urban gardening in the Phoenix, Arizona area. Forrest Palmer breaks hopium by drawing similarities between fracking in Colorado and the uprising in Missouri. Our Doom of the Week, Christy Lewis, comments about her efforts to transmit climate change information to the public and the response from the Australian government. So that's what we're going to get through today, hopefully. And we'll start in a minute. But before we get going, a couple things that happened to me this week, and particularly on my Facebook page. I got started by posting a couple of articles on racial struggles going on in this particular country, and one of them was on the Washington Redskins, and the other one, of course, was on the Michael Brown shooting. And, of course, when I post stuff like this, generally what happens is the white males of my Facebook world come out of the woodwork and try to give me some advice on how I should be talking about race and looking at racial matters. So in this case, we'll start with the Washington Redskins article. And it was interesting because I posted the article, and right away I got a response from, I'll just say, a white male in his 50s, about my age. And what seems to happen here is that if I stray off script of whiteness, and I wait too long, I really don't have to wait too long before my fellow club members kind of try to set me back on the right path. And in the club I'm talking about, the membership I'm talking about, of course, is white supremacy, and not the KKK or the neo-Nazi type of white supremacy, but the kind that is much more clever and dangerous. You see, the white supremacy club that I'm referring to rationalizes ignorance and racism and cloaks it with phrases like, well, the Redskins name was picked out of reverence and toughness for Indians, or it's a team name and not an individual name. You have to take into consideration the context of the word and how it's being used. Or my favorite, racists don't even use Redskin when they're referring to Native Americans, and that's largely due in part to its use in a positive manner as an American sports team beloved and respected by millions of people. The conversation ended poorly because apparently I hurt his feelings by insinuating that his attitudes towards the Washington Redskins made him sound like an old white guy. And again, maybe I should have insinuated that he was a middle-aged white guy because he's in his 50s and that's about where I am. Maybe if I would have used the term old white guy in the context of reverence and toughness, then it would have been okay. As my friend Greg Rivers points out, the general rule of thumb here, guys, is this. If you'd be unwilling to call a member of a group in question the team nickname to his or her face, it's probably not a good team nickname to have. In other words, if you can't say it to them, then I don't care what context it's in. It's still offensive, it's still ignorant, and it's still racist. Or how about this? How about just not continuing to look like an ignorant ass? That might be a good start as well. In the Michael Brown shooting, the conversation that I had with, again, another white male that kind of came out of the woodwork, this was a much more civil conversation, a much more intelligent conversation. But it was brought to my attention certain points he was trying to make. And one of the points he made was, this is a white man on trial and not a black man. So if we believe the system to be fair for white men and unfair for black men, then logic says the racial makeup of this jury is irrelevant. And then another point that he made was, you've condemned the jury to have racial epithets before they even had a chance. I guess I could argue that if a guy had a mustache, then half should at least like mustaches or not find them creepy. So these are the points that people are trying to make. I think what goes over their heads on some level is the concept of institutional systemic racism. They know the definition, but they have a really difficult time identifying it when they see it or hear it. They tend to look at racism in personal terms and are somewhat oblivious, or they just disregard the impact of history and its impact on our institutions and systems. When I have to point out that skin color plays a factor in many of these cases, well, that's something white men just really don't like to hear. They assume that there is a trust in the system, a trust that has never been earned from people of color. They want to look at the facts and logic, but they exclude the fact that our country has a history that is greatly impacted by the events we see today. Logically, they can't seem to grasp the fact that our prisons are full of black men and our justice system and police forces play an enormous role in maintaining and multiplying those numbers. Finally, they refuse to face the reality of our predicament. There is no solution when you have institutions and systems that are built and maintained and structured with oppression. In other words, oppression is required. If there are haves, there will always be have-nots, and the dominant narrative calls this meritocracy. I call it a lie. And it's amazing what listening to those who haven't had the white status quo experience can teach you. May I suggest that we, white men, maybe shut up a little more and maybe listen a little more. And, of course, you can cue the white man response on my Facebook wall. So it's time for our first segment, which is the not-so-mainstream news. And we're going to start with Guy McPherson's segment. So Guy will start us off on the not-so-mainstream news.
My segment of news beyond the mainstream comes from boingboing.net. It was posted the 20th of August. And it doubles as my climate change update for the week. It's written by Cory Doctorow, entitled Canadian Government Orders Scientists Not to Disclose Extent of Polar Melting. That's all you really need to know, but here's the lead. Quote, Stephen Harper's Petro Tories have a well-earned reputation for suppressing inconvenient environmental science, but they attained new Stalinist lows when their ministers prohibited Canadian ICE services from disclosing their government-funded research on the rapid loss of Arctic ice, end quote. George Orwell nailed this one when he wrote, "The further a society drifts from the truth, the more it will hate those who speak it."
Okay. That was Guy McPherson's not-so-mainstream headline news piece. Mine is an article that comes from commondreams.org, and my headline is "Women Warriors Take on Environmental Protection in Their Own Hands," and it was written by Amantha Pereira, and it's about a woman named Aleta Bon, an Indonesian environmental activist known in her community as Mama Aleta, and she is part of the Molo people of Indonesia. She is the winner of the 2013 Goldman Environmental Prize, and she represents an expanding international movement against environmental destruction, helmed by humble, often poor, and rural and tribal women. For many years, Aleta has been at the forefront of her tribe's efforts to stop mining companies from destroying the forests and the mountains that hug the western part of her country and her island. Starting in the 1980s, corporations seeking to extract marble from the rich region acquired permits from local officials and began a period of mining and deforestation that caused landslides and rampant pollution. "I felt they were raping my land," she said. "I could not just stand aside and watch it happen." She eventually was stabbed, but this did not stop her efforts, which culminated in a peaceful occupation in the mountain area that led to these companies eventually ceasing operations. The United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change estimates that women comprise one of the most vulnerable populations to fallout from extreme weather events. In addition, small-scale female farmers, who number some 500 million worldwide, produce between 45 and 80% of the world's food, while rural women, primarily in Asia and sub-Saharan Africa, spend an estimate 200 million hours per day fetching water, according to the UN Women. Any change in their climate, experts say, will be acutely felt. And finally, according to Lorena Aguilar, senior gender advisor with the International Union of Conservation and Nature, in some parts of rural India, women spend 30% of their time looking for water. The role and the environment they live on have a symbiotic connection, she said. Words to live by, of course, and it's the connection that we seem to be missing in the dominant culture. Well, we're going to move on, and we are going to have our guest join us here in a second. And his name is Greg Peterson. And Greg Peterson is a green and living sustainability innovator sharing his passion to grow food in our cities. And in 2001, he created the Urban Farm, an environmental showcase home in the heart of Phoenix, which he opens periodically for tours and classes. Having grown food in Phoenix for over four decades, Greg is well-versed in urban sustainability and food production. The Urban Farm at theurbanfarm.org features an entirely edible landscape, including over 85 fruit trees, rain, water, and gray water harvesting, three solar applications, and extensive use of reclaimed and recycled building materials. Greg has a master's degree in urban and environmental planning in December of 2006 from Arizona State University, where he now teaches a class called Sustainable Food and Farms. Greg is the co-founder of the Valley Permaculture Alliance and is on the board of directors for Sustainable Arizona and co-developed a 200-hour online urban farming curriculum. Greg's mission: to each day inspire people into their own level of greenness. So we're going to move on to one of our favorite segments, and that is Breaking Hopium. In a culture full of hope in the forms of technology, wishful thinking, and great awakening by the industrial power structure, meaning, quite frankly, ourselves, and what Derek Jensen calls a culture of make-believe, some important voices are speaking truth to power. Each week, we will have a brief opinion piece or pieces. In this segment called Breaking Hopium, we hear from radical perspectives that cut to the root of an issue and expose some truth that has been widely hidden or filed under the oblivious for the general populace. This week, we hear from Forrest Palmer.
"A community is under siege today. It isn't in control of its environment and is being told what to do by the state. Although the people in the community want one thing, they are being forced to do another. The people have spoken and no one is listening. The listener is more than likely thinking that I'm referring to the current uprising in Ferguson, Missouri. But no, I'm referring to the current situation in Fort Collins, Colorado. In the last election, on November 5th, 2013, the community voted to put a five-year moratorium on hydraulic fracturing, more commonly referred to as fracking, that would disallow the oil and gas companies from using this process to drill for natural gas. But a judge on August 8th, 2014, threw out the voter initiative, and a trend is definitely occurring. In 2012, another Colorado community, Longmont, came to the same conclusion and decided to ban fracking. But a judge also threw out this decision by the voters. And these two communities are just examples of many others mired in a fight against the state that's protecting corporate interests. But here's the thing. What people fail to realize is that I am indirectly talking about Ferguson, Missouri, since all these communities that are in the process of fighting for their lives have the state to contend with regarding their particular problem. In Ferguson, Missouri, it is not only the killing of a young man, Michael Brown, by a racist state, but socioeconomic impoverishment that is dictated by capitalism and is need of labor or lack of need. In Colorado, it is communities that are being slowly poisoned by oil and gas industries, which will put industry and the necessary growth of an economy built upon industrialization before any type of allegiance to the people, racial or otherwise. Due to mutual self-interest, if nothing else, you would think that all these communities would band together, those battling environmental degradation due to industry and others facing a veritable hell of being black and the most targeted by a racist state. Sadly, though, I see no signs of this occurring. The inability of white people who hold the power, even at the grassroots level, to see that at the foundation of all this is a need to divide and conquer to keep the capitalist state going is what will disable a bridge being built between the ones in Colorado and New York and Texas that are almost exclusively white, yet having to deal with the intrusion of fracking, and the ones in Detroit and St. Louis and Washington, D.C., that are almost exclusively black, yet have to deal with the intrusion of the police. Sadly, this shows that the largest dividing line in the country still remains race and white supremacy to this day. As cynical as I am, and also being a student of history, I don't ever see this gap being bridged. But every night I go to bed, hoping I am truly wrong.
Thank you, Forrest Palmer, for this week's Breaking Hopium. We have Greg Peterson on the line. I read his bio to you, and Greg is the creator of The Urban Farm. Welcome to Nature Bats Last, Greg.
Thank you.
You and I met a few years ago, and I took the tour of the urban farm in your home, and was blown away by what could be done in an urban setting. I mean, it was one of these things where you drive up, and there's all these cars for the tour, and people are rolling out, and I'm like, wow, where is this place? And it's basically just kind of, a house in the middle of the neighborhood that looks like any other house until you really start to look closely at what's being done. So I guess a good place to start would be really defining for folks what urban farming looks like.
Okay, I can do that. Absolutely. So really it looks like whatever you want to dream it up to look like. I can tell you about the urban farm, and I will do that here in a minute. I just watched a video at GothamGreens.com, which is some friends of mine in New York City, and they have a 20,000 square foot greenhouse on the top of a Whole Foods, and they're hydroponically growing food in this greenhouse and then shipping it downstairs to sell it. Okay. And the last line of this video, the gentleman that is one of the people that owns it says, "And I'm an urban farmer."
Right on.
Yeah, exactly. So the urban farm itself is something I created about 15 years ago, and I like to call it an environmental showcase home. Okay. And to do exactly what you spoke of there, and that's to invite the public in to see what's possible. And the basis for what I do here is that I don't believe that you shouldn't grow anything that doesn't give you food or supports giving you food.
Right.
So like in the case of flowers, I grow flowers here. Well, that brings pollinators in so that we get more food. So really my rendition of urban farming is that I have an entirely edible landscape, or it supports edibles here at the urban farm. and I grow food here. Given that we live in the desert, I get to do it 12 months a year. And so there's always some, there's always a few meals in the yard.
Absolutely. I mean, it's an incredible place. It's, you know, like I said, it when you walk up, it's very unassuming until you start really taking the tour and you're pointing out how this particular system works and what's growing here. And then you start to realize the absolute waste that you have in your own yard, waste of space and in resources, so to speak. I lived in Phoenix 15 years, and I never really considered while I was there the idea of food shortages until I think it was probably, almost 6-7 years ago when we had the gas shortage. We had that pipeline issue.
Yep.
And I showed up one day from being out of town, and I was driving to work, and all the gas stations had yellow tape around them. And then eventually when people started to get a hold of this, I had to go, like most people, get in line or leave my car to get gas. And the panic that was involved – and this is just gas we're talking about here.
Yeah, just gas. Exactly.
We're not talking about food. We're not talking about water. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about supply, food supply in a given urban area, and why that urban gardening is a smart, effective way to supplement or possibly replace a lot of the store-bought foods.
Yeah, so we have a on-demand food system, just like we have an on-demand gasoline system and an on-demand product system. And basically what that means is as we need it, it shows up on the store shelves.
Right.
So we don't have months worth of food supplies here in the valley. In fact, and actually really in any city, we don't have months worth of food. How much time of food do you think is on the grocery shelves here in most major cities?
I mean, if I had to guess, I would say less than a week.
Definitely less than a week. It's like 3 days.
Yeah.
And here's what I tell people about that. That is, we have a 3-day supply or 9 meals of food in any given urban area. But the second that anybody gets wind that, you know, that food stops coming in,
right,
we have maybe 3 hours.
Right. It was like when people were filling up their lawnmowers and every device that took gas.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So that presents a significant problem to, you know, urban food security, urban security in general.
Right, right.
And so my spiel about this is hey, I'm not saying that, you know, that food's going to stop coming into the city. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is that we should grow food in all of our yards. And if that ever happens, then we have food growing everywhere. And if it doesn't, we have food growing everywhere.
Right. And you obviously learn something.
Yeah.
Which is a big deal. Forrest Palmer, who actually did a segment right before you, because we were trying to get you on, and he contributes to Nature Bats Last. And he made a good point the other day online about trying to keep things real so people can see the impact in their daily lives.
Yeah.
Instead of just speaking, you know, in general ideological terms to people. And it seems to me that when you present people with what they can do individually and what they can do now,
yeah,
and at the same time show them the impact environmentally and personally, I think it's something that's actually pretty powerful. And, you know, we talk about food miles all the time and, you know, where your food comes from. And so what are your thoughts about making those connections to people? And maybe we can begin with, you know, the concept of eating what's in season and how that connects to food miles in general.
Oh, yeah. So I actually teach at Arizona State University, and I was in class today. Mm-hmm. Classes started last week, and I asked – we were talking about food miles and how far food travels, and somebody said, well, I ate a banana from Ecuador. So Ecuador is like 4,900 miles away.
Right, right.
So when we stop to think about that banana and it had to travel 4,900 miles to get to our grocery store, the environmental impact is huge. The shipping impact is huge.
Right.
But one of the things that we often miss in that process is – that banana had to be picked completely unripe.
Yeah.
So that it had time to ship. And one of the things that we don't typically know is that when you're picking something and it's not ripe, the nutritional value isn't there.
Yeah. So it's a great point.
Yeah. So we're actually picking food, before it's ripe, shipping it many hundreds or thousands of miles, and it ripens somewhere along the way. But the other thing you may not know is that when it the moment you pick it, the nutrition starts degrading in it. So essentially what we're doing by shipping food many miles is that it's nutritionless food. You know, it's lacking nutrition. So there's that piece of it. And so that's why I tell people to eat, you know, eat what's in season. And basically what that means is that you find out what is ripe at any given season, and that's what you're eating.
Right. So so what's happening in most cases of this healthy salad you're eating has lost a great deal of its nutritional value.
Exactly.
If different pieces of that salad are you know, adding up to whatever astronomical
exactly.
number of miles.
Right. Exactly.
A couple of things. Clearly, the city itself, a city like Phoenix or a city that's in a similar locale, like Las Vegas, in desert locations that were never probably imagined to be this size, prior to the fossil fuel era. What do you see are the challenges for urban farmers, particularly with, I guess we could start with the obvious, which is water.
Water, yes. Well, first of all, we water lawns here.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're basically looking at trade-offs. And I think if push comes to shove, I mean, we have a huge drought going on in California.
Right.
They're on level 2. When it goes to level 4, they stop watering food in California.
Wow.
A significant amount of our food comes in from California.
So we're halfway.
Right. Exactly. So basically we're just looking at trade-offs. Mm-hmm. And what, you know, if we're going to live 4 million people in the desert,
right.
And I don't know how many people are in Las Vegas, but you know, we need to look at trade-offs and the value of those trade-offs. The cool thing is though that we can, with the new technologies that are out, and even some of the older technologies are out, the watering is not as big of an issue,
right?
Because you know, hydroponics uses like 10% of the water of traditional growing.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's, you know, there are different technologies that we can use that address the water thing. You know, number one, stop growing grass.
Yeah. So I guess one of the things we're eventually going to have to look at, which a lot of people don't want to look at, you know, and I'm myself included, I'm astonished at, you know, the amount of water that goes into, for example, the park that is next door to my house.
Uh-huh.
To keep the grass green, and the golf courses.
Yeah.
You're right, push comes to shove. Those are going to have to be some very logical, it seems to me, trade-offs.
Yeah.
Which I'm disappointed that we're not making already on some levels.
Yeah. Well, and the other piece of that, they're still planting houses like mad here.
Right.
With no view of what's going to happen into the future.
Yeah, so. And I think that's the thing. You know, I moved here in the mid-90s, and the growth of this city since then is incredible.
Oh, yeah.
Places that you would drive out to, and it would be desert a few miles out of town, there's subdivisions. And
right.
You're right, they're watering their lawns.
Yeah. Well, and you know the truth of the matter is, don't you?
What's that?
Nature always bats last.
Nature does bat last. Thanks for the plug, Greg.
Yeah. nature's gonna handle this one way or the other.
It is. People don't like to hear that either, but you're right.
Oh, well.
You know what the
cool thing here is? That we can actually say that.
You're right.
You know, there's places out there that I can't say that yet.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's true. As far as infrastructure changes, do you see anything changing? Because you're involved in a lot of different levels, education wise, organization wise. Do you see infrastructure changing, or do you see plans of it changing, or anything on that level?
Well, you know, I work at a grassroots level. I fully believe that from the ground up model is the significant way to make great change in the world. And what I see out there every day is this food revolution where people are interested in what's in their food.
Mm-hmm.
Do you realize there are over 20,000 items that they can put in your food in a factory and they don't have to put it on the label?
Right.
Typically those are you know, those are chemicals.
Right.
So, you know, people are very interested in what's in their food, where their food is coming from. You know, recently I did a lecture at one of the local bookstores and, mm-hmm. and, you know, I'll get maybe 50 people come out. Well, this day of, it's been about a year and a half ago now. Something happened in the stock market and we lost track at 267 people.
Wow.
That's how many people were interested in coming out to listen to, hey, here's how you start growing your own food.
Right. And you know, I think people think it's something that they could never possibly do, and right. which is fascinating to me because in most cases, it's not even a generation removed from their actual family.
Right, exactly.
You know, like when I was a kid, my parents had gardens. They don't have gardens now. They have a brick backyard. And so I think it's an intimidation factor until something grows in front of their eyes that they actually pulled off.
Right.
And then it seems that – in a lot of cases, at least in the experience I've had of helping put people's gardens together or helping them harvest or grow and plant, is that is kind of the slippery slope. Once they get their first produce,
yeah,
they jump head in.
Yeah, so, exactly.
And it's exciting to see. So, talk to me about some of the things you're doing now to get people kind of started. You know, somebody listening to the show and they want to get started next week or they want to next month. What can they do now?
Well, if it's okay to say it, urbanfarm.org is my website. And on the front page of urbanfarm.org, there is a free ebook on urban farming. We've got an urban farmer boot camp coming up, and I think you have the link for that you can put out on your website.
Yes, I do.
For people to, you know, come to a free webinar in September on, you know, just how you can grow your own food. You know, I've been doing this a long time, educating people a long time here in Phoenix, and I've finally discovered how to actually put it online. So I've got a lot of online content coming on, you know, how you can create and grow your own food.
Right. Which, it's that being said, what got, you know, it always takes something. For me, it took reading a book like Ishmael to push into a different space. You know, and we've had this conversation a few years ago about that book.
Yep.
And I guess what was that if there was a moment or moments that kind of got you, you know, kicked you in the butt and said, I'm going to do something different.
Well, I don't really ever have an answer for that because mm-hmm. it feels to me like I was born with it. In the eighth grade, so 1975, I was about 14. I wrote a paper. I hand wrote it in pencil on how we were overfishing the oceans.
Wow.
So I'm not able to trace it back to something that happened this time around. Mm-hmm. I just know that there is something deeply wrong with how we're living on the planet and how we're growing food on this planet. Cause there's a problem there. So I have pretty much dedicated my every day to, you know, enlightening people and sharing with people and mentoring people and teaching people, you know, where their food comes from and why it's important.
Right. I mean, so, you know, that being said, you're expressing yourself of how we're living and in the deep concern you have during your time doing this or getting to these conclusions and these points. Have you had some, because we deal with a lot of people on this show and a lot of people on our websites that kind of have this roller coaster of emotion, you know, you seem like a pretty positive guy. I was wondering, you know, at times there's got to be where you're just, and in what you do to keep going and to keep motivated and to keep, you know, your spirits up.
Yeah. So just so you know that I do run into that wall. Mm-hmm. I called a buddy of mine who is Bill McDormand. He's a nationally known seed teacher. He teaches about seeds. And it's like, Bill, help me here because I do get to a place where, you know what, us human beings, we're a virus living on the planet and we've – you know, there are days when I can't see how to get around this. Like, it's going to be over someday, mm-hmm. probably sooner than later. Right. I get there. And the truth of the matter is that I believe in miracles.
Mm-hmm.
And One of the things I am so incredibly blessed with is the opportunity to teach at Arizona State University, and I teach electives. I teach two of them, and I usually have between 80 and 100 students a semester.
Okay.
And these kids are brilliant. They're the 18 to 24 year old. They're electing to be in the class,
which is a big deal.
that's a huge deal. And they're there and present and looking at how to create change. You know, I mentioned Gotham Greens a little earlier, you know, my friend Jen in New York City. And I knew her when she and I were undergraduate students at Arizona State University in 2002, 2003, 2004. And she was studying hydroponics back then.
Okay.
And look what she's done. You know, they've got a 15,000 square foot greenhouse and a 20,000 square foot greenhouse on office buildings, and they got another one coming. So there is the technology, and I don't for one minute think that the technology is the savior here, but it's definitely going to contribute to the brilliance that I think will shift our path going forward. And one of the big things that we have to pay attention to is not being that we know more than Mother Nature.
Right.
About 15 years ago, I wrote, "Our downfall as a species is that we're arrogant enough to think that we can control Mother Nature and stupid enough to think it's our job."
Right.
And so the moment that we shift from thinking we're better than Mother Nature to remembering that we're part of Mother Nature and working in the flow of nature, because there's so many things that can be done in a – I'm going to use a different word – a regenerative way,
mm-hmm.
That's the way nature works. Nature works in closed loop systems where everything gets used. I think one of the biggest downfalls to the human species is that we throw things away. Waste is the biggest, most horrendous problem on this planet. And if we can figure out how to unplug that and not have any waste, then we're going to be so much farther ahead.
Yeah, you have much more optimism than me, but that's okay because, you know, yeah. It's a good balance. And, you know, I'll be honest, most of the people, the 18 listeners that we have to this show at this point, are probably in a much darker place in their thinking of where we're headed. It depends for me. It's on a daily basis.
Me too.
And I like you, I know, you know, this – our species isn't going to be around forever because species aren't around forever.
Right.
And obviously, we're accelerating our time here and shortening it by doing what we're doing. As a teacher myself, when I taught high school, I think the self-discovery that I made, which was took me to a darker place, was that I had students like you who I saw a great deal of brilliance in, and I had a lot of hope for them, and I still do on a lot of levels.
Yeah.
And nobody knows what's going to happen and how it's going to happen and all that. I think what concerns me is that what I refer to as the dominant culture, industrial civilization, because not everybody is in industrial civilization, but the education system, as I see it, is we are teaching kids to think critically in some aspects and think about things differently because we see things aren't working. But where I get a little disappointed, I should say a great deal disappointed, is that it's still in the framework of, as Daniel Quinn says, there is not one way to live, although if you're born and raised in the industrial model, it seems to be that there is no other way to live. And quite frankly, I'm not blaming anybody because that's all we've ever known.
Exactly.
You know, we don't have a skill set that we can just go back to and become primitive. And for me, that's kind of where I guess the rubber meets the road, and I'm like, so where do we go from here? So that's really where I'm coming from and where – I guess the darkness in my own thought generally starts to stem from is, you know, if we're taking these kids and they're doing great things, but they're still doing it from a domesticated industrial model on some level, where is that going to lead? So,
yeah. So I actually speak to that a lot in my classes, because here I tell people,
I guess.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Well, and just keep listening.
Yeah.
Here's what I tell people. Sustainability is done.
Yeah.
Sustainability simply sustains the mess we've created for a longer period of time.
I agree.
So, and that's exactly
what
you're...
It's a mess, really, in the way we're living.
Right, exactly. And so that's why I talk a lot about regenerative design and creating regenerative systems. And regenerative systems speak to pretty much everything you were talking about. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, the truth of the matter, with a capital T, is we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
Right.
We don't know what's going to happen next year. We don't know what's going to happen in 5 or 10 or even 50 years. We really don't know. I mean, I have an idea of what's going to happen,
yeah,
but we don't know.
No, and I think that's the problem, Greg, even in what I call the doomer world in which I'm a part of,
uh-huh,
is that we still have that mindset that it's really the dominant culture mindset where we're always out there. Our head is out there, and it's never in the present or rarely in the present. And so
right,
we're thinking, well, we're screwed, and it's out there, and this is going to happen.
Right.
And we're missing what's actually happening right now.
Right.
Which is life.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Plus, there are so many cool things going on out there right now.
Yeah.
There's so many cool things. God, I can't remember his first name. His last name is De Palmier. Mm-hmm. Wrote a book a couple of years ago called Vertical Farming. I mean, there's this whole movement in cities to, you know, put food growing up.
Right. And, you know, that's what I tell people. You know, my tagline for what I've been doing with my wife for the last 3 years is chase a different carrot. And that doesn't,
yep,
necessarily mean you have to do what I'm doing. But, you know, whether or not you think things are going to go down in the next 2 years or you think they're going to go down in the next century, that to me gives you a free license to do something, anything,
yes,
other than what you're doing, because
yes,
clearly that's not working. And so,
right,
I get a little frustrated with people when they're still, their head is out there and they're like, well, we got these reinforcing feedback loops and it's all going down. And I agree with them on a lot of levels. But at the same time, what are you doing today to enjoy your life?
Right.
And I think that's why I applaud what you're doing, because for me, it's very present.
Yeah.
You're in an urban area. And, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, my God, you live in a city. That's, you know, you're screwed. But you're doing something in an,
yeah,
urban area, and you're doing something that you love and that you enjoy and that people learn from. And that's really what it's about for me, because it's present.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Go ahead.
I actually was quoted in an article recently. One of my stated goals, mm-hmm, is that between now and when I die, I intend to create a food system here in Phoenix that grows enough food to feed Phoenix. And
hey,
I don't know how the heck I'm going to do that.
Yeah. But the idea that's you're working on something and it's present and it's always within you, I think that's a big thing, instead of just being out there and letting it overwhelm you, because,
yeah,
you know, then to me, you're not really living on a lot of levels. So
yeah, I completely agree with that.
Well, any last thoughts here? We'd love to have you back maybe sometime in the spring and see what you're up to and what you're doing.
Yeah.
But any parting thoughts?
You know what? Get out and play in the food revolution. There's so many ways to do it. You can shop at a farmer's market. You can grow your own food. You can go to restaurants that are growing, you know, buying locally grown food. But, you know, play in that arena.
Yeah, get dirt.
Yeah, get your hands dirty, man. It's, you know, my brother is a financial planner here in town, and it's my dad's business,
okay,
that he started in the 1980s, and dad tried to get me to take over the business. And it was
right,
like, I looked at my dad's one day and I said, Dad, see these hands? They're full of calluses. That's the way I want them.
Right.
You know, I'm a farmer.
You're a farmer, and you're, from what I have seen, you're a damn good one.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that greatly.
Absolutely. So thank you, Greg, for being on, and we hope we can touch base with you sometime, maybe next year.
That would be awesome.
All right.
I'll keep in touch. Thank
Got
you.
That's Greg Peterson, the Urban Farm, urbanfarm.org. And if you want to look at his boot camp, I would recommend it and go to his site. I will post that information on our walls as well. Well, each week we have a doomer of the week, and we look for that person to go beyond the status quo in their rhetoric or analysis, but also may provide insightful and useful information to the issues at hand. Here is Guy with this doomer of the week.
Doomer of the week this week comes from Christy Lewis in the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group on Facebook. She writes about a project to develop an app to demonstrate real-life climate change to ordinary people. She says to her supervisor, okay, let's model temperature, sea level rise, and worst-case climate scenarios of the IPCC, as they look pretty tame compared to what's really going on. Boss's response, no, we are not permitted to model sea level rise in this app. She responds, but sir, this is important. With the scientific evidence, most of the coastal regions will be inundated in the next 50 years. Boss says, no, we will not be modeling this in the app. She says, okay, well, what will you give me to work with then? Boss says, best case scenario is working with the temperature and rainfall. Christy replies, isn't that lying to the general public by not sharing the correct information with them? Boss says, we have been instructed to model best case scenarios. You have been given your instructions. No, do your job. She says, it's a fiction, though. We have already surpassed most of these thresholds. Boss says, end of discussion. This is a government organization. The moral of this story is the governments do not want you to know the true science behind climate change. Christy finishes with, to my beautiful daughters and future generations, I am truly sorry for the crimes that these men are being allowed to commit. And then further down the Facebook thread, she comments, I think it was made worse as I really believed I could possibly have made a difference with this project. It just furthers my convictions that we are all fracked.
And that is this week's Doomer of the Week. This week's climate summary and update is brief yet important. Here is Guy again in our much-anticipated climate summary and update for August 26, 2014.
This week, my climate change update is a commentary on policy, not science. As I said at the top of the show, this week's story comes from boingboing.net on the 20th of August. It's written by Cory Doctorow and titled, Canadian Government Orders Scientists Not to Disclose Extent of Polar Melting. And that's really all we need to know.
Yes, that I guess it is all we need to know. Winding up this week, a couple things. If you would like to be Doomer of the Week, keep going out there and pushing beyond the mainstream, of course, and the status quo. And if you want to be inspired, I guess I would start reading the posts of Forrest Palmer or listening to Forrest Palmer, because he is what I refer to as the most honest man on the internet. Again, if you want more information, you can like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last, and the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM group on Facebook as well. Make sure you post your questions. We will probably start answering questions in the near term, and we would also like to eventually move to answering some emails and, this may sound crazy, maybe even phone calls down the road. So if you like to post those questions, we will try and get to them. Guy's blog, Nature Bats Last, you can check that for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. And finally, if you're finding yourself in need of support in dealing with these heavy issues, please find the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group on Facebook and join the conversation. There are plenty of people who may be going through a similar emotional roller coaster and may be able to help you and provide some personal insight to these monumental issues. In fact, here is a voice Guy found on this week's support group page.
From the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group on Facebook comes this comment from Roblin Crawford, and she's responding to somebody else who is disappointed about the dire nature of the news and the massive attempts by nearly everybody in this culture to suppress the dire news. So Roblin Crawford writes, "Ah, me too, honey. In my environmental studies grad program, they focus on solutions to prevent the students from getting too depressed to complete the curriculum. It just makes me angry that this stuff is not being discussed in academia. Guy McPherson applied to speak at a TED talk, and my professor turned him down because no one else was saying the things he was saying, so she assumed he wasn't credible. I explained the phenomenon of erring on the side of least drama that scientists have been exhibiting, and there are studies that support this. And she is going to take another look at his research. I think she mentioned the cherry-picking thing, which is always a danger when you're doing a broad presentation that shows many specific examples of cutting-edge research that together draw a larger picture. Anyway, I am determined to break the academic barrier."
Thank you. That's this week's support group message. And it's a very good group. You can find always a ton of information on the page. It's always being updated literally every 15 minutes. If you post something, it's down the page away. So if you want it to be read, I would suggest maybe starting to comment on it and getting discussion going there yourself. Finally, this evening, my wife and I, as I mentioned before, we live in a yurt, a Mongolian garret, or as we call it again, a really nice tent. It's 300 square feet, and people are always interested from the life we left behind to come and visit and see what we're doing. And so since we've left 3 years ago and been on our journey, so to speak, of chasing a different carrot, we've had different visitors. And particularly, we've had a lot of visitors in the last 6 months since we moved into the garret. And I just wanted to share some thoughts about some of the visits that I've had and what I've noticed, not only from people that visit, but when I come back to a city like, you know, a city I lived in for 15 years, Phoenix. And I refer to it when I come back or I see people that are from my old life as the underlying sadness and fear of people who still believe in sustainable living, which is something that Greg Peterson touched on, and that sustainability really is a myth. And so I wrote a couple thoughts here. People come to visit us in our gear. I mean, when you live in a yurt, or as we call it, a really nice tent, people are, of course, curious. So they want to see us and catch up, but they also want to see how we live. I think on some levels they're surprised. Our home is beautiful and very cozy. It's comfortable and it feels lived in. As the visit moves on, we try and dispel any beliefs or stories that may have developed about the way we live. One way to do this is we just have them drive us to Walmart and we buy some beer. Another way to do this is to have some conversations about sustainability. Breaking the myth of sustainable living in a culture that breeds the opposite is an interesting discussion to have. What is ultimately, and what it does, is it breaks the idea that there are solutions to our predicaments. Predicaments, of course, do not have solutions, but that never stopped our savior complex before, so why should it be any different now? When the savior or problem-solving strategy is put to rest, all that is left is the self-reflection, which quickly is justified and justifies one's living arrangement, which in turn reeks of fear and sadness. Over the past 3 years, we've had some 30 people come to visit us while we were out chasing a different carrot. And when you leave your career behind and live without cars or a cell phone and you crap in a bucket, you sort of become entertainment for some. This isn't a bad thing because I find it entertaining as well. The only difference is that my wife and I are the actual experiment instead of the observers. Anyway, the people that visit are some of the brightest and most interesting people I know from the way from the life I left behind. Their desire to learn and challenge themselves is really the reason why they come to visit, and it's not necessarily convenient or always comfortable for them. Unfortunately, they are very fearful of making any significant changes in their own lives, and this is felt through their sadness. Accepting a fate that is not what one would ultimately choose is sad, and living in a state of fear is sad. Not being able to recognize it is tragic. Being able to recognize it and still remain trapped by it reflects how powerful indoctrination and domestication really are. My wife and I are not living sustainably. We know one person who may fit that description, and it's a long road to hoe. Whether or not we get there will make no difference in the universe. It will, however, make a difference in our perspective. What we have discovered is something that is attainable right now. It's attainable for everyone that has come to visit over the past 3 years. That discovery is ownership and letting go of the story we tell ourselves about ourselves. Avoiding ownership of land, houses, cars, and other major investments is freedom. Being able to walk away from everything and anything is freedom. Challenging the notion that we must build a credit score to attain stuff and status is enslavement. Going to school and then to work to build our foundation towards a life of indentured servitude is fear-based and, quite frankly, sad. We, as an industrial culture, are domesticated. Domesticated animals are controlled. Taking an animal out of its pen, cage, or cubicle for a brief period of time is not freedom. It's a trick. Don't believe me? Then notice how quickly the excuses in your head start to build when I ask why you haven't walked away from your debt, your job, investments, or any other thing that keeps you and yours from a life outside of what is expected. You, like me, have been domesticated. The only difference is I took a step towards the exit of such a life. It's a small step, which domestication distorts as a large step. My wife and I are living as we move towards the exit. We suspect you'll have a similar experience. Well, folks, that's about it for this week. We appreciate you listening. If you miss us, make sure you find us in the archives at prn.fm and rate us on iTunes. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end, nature bats last. Thanks, Aprazin.
Gonna get you.